Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send us a recipe or a comment or favorite email, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. Or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, they are archived on our website at recipeforpeacenow.com. Thanks. Now let's get started. This time we're going to be talking about creating change. And I suppose that that's what we always do, isn't it? Because we have some issues that need to be resolved. And when we resolve them successfully and have a successfully negotiated outcome, we have created change, haven't we? We've changed something. We've changed the positions of for the issues of the participants, of outsiders, of the public, of whatever it is we're trying to do. Yes. But let's talk about it specifically this time. What types of change do we want to create within our context? The context of an alternative dispute resolution, a negotiation, a mediation, perhaps a workshop or a seminar where we are teaching people how to create change. Yes. And we're teaching by example and showing them how. What types of change do we oftentimes want to do within our context? Oh, I see we have lots of people. Thank you all for being here. I'm going to say that the first topic that we're going to talk about is changing what I'm going to call the group dynamic. Changing the group dynamic. We have people talking about hostility, that there's hostility within the group, and we need to change it, and mistrust, and bias, which a lot of people are calling bigotry, yes, pardon me, and also within the group dynamic, which greatly affects it, sometimes we have subgroups, we have exclusionary subgroups, cliques, groups of people who only talk to each other. Right? And excluding the others. I would also like to change within our group dynamic. I'm going to make this a broad category of negativity. People don't think they're going to make it, and they're just putting in their time because someone forced them to show up. Right? Negativity. And yes, this I'm going to put this under group dynamic too. A lot of folks are talking about changing the actual makeup of the group, changing who's in it. Right? Yeah. Then we're going to have another general topic, I think, which is going to be changing perceptions. Changing perceptions. The public perception, right, which we're going to use media for, and also the group dynamic perception, right, of this can't be done. We're going to change our perception from this is impossible to wait a minute, let's think about how to make it possible. Look, we're getting somewhere. Let's keep going forward, right? And then let's make a third category, and I'm doing this from everybody's comments and like that. And thank you so much. You know this is an unscripted show. It goes where it takes us, where the people are interested in talking about. I'm going to call this future change, right? The change in the law, the change in the custom. Kind of a change in hierarchy. Who controls what's happening? That's a future change, a change that will be effective in the future going forward, so that whatever we do from there, our position will have changed, our way of doing it will have changed, right? Yeah. So let's get down to it, because We are practical people, and we want to know what it is that we're going to do about these things, and not just talk about them, but say, you know, what should we do? Mm-hmm. The group dynamic one is first. So what should we do to make the group dynamic stronger when we're faced with hostility, mistrust, bias, cliques, which are exclusionary subgroups, negativity, and maybe even the participant makeup? We need to change the people in the group, maybe. Which is usually, I must say maybe, because it's usually my last resort to have to throw someone out. Because they're there for a reason. And it very much depends. You know, let's do group makeup first, just because we're talking about it. And people are asking. The answer is that frequently, at least in my world, I don't know about yours, if you have volunteers, it may be completely different. If you're doing an organization, a volunteer group to try to change some sort of perception, to change some sort of law or something like that, you might be able to pick and choose your people. And you might vote someone out. I don't like to do it. I don't like to say you're out as the leader. I like to take a vote. I like to make sure that we're all in accord that this is something that needs to be done. Because otherwise you will have lingering resentment in the group that somebody's friend, somebody's associate, somebody you agreed with, was thrown out. If we're going to have someone not be in the group, we take a vote. We kind of do it. I'm very careful about that. A lot of times I see groups where I cannot change the group numbers. I cannot change the members of the group. They are there because of some sort of a business level. I do a lot of corporations. Mm-hmm. They are in some way important to the group, or I cannot choose to have them dismissed. We might have to talk to a superior, this is true, but it's not my decision. I can bring it up to somebody, but it's not my decision, and I'd have to have cause. In that case, we're going to have to deal with changing them so that they are not poisoning the group dynamic. And that's the key to it. That's the creating change. We're going to work on making them a part of a positive group dynamic. And it can be done. And it can be done with some private discussion about it too. You explain to them that unless they want to have the bosses know about this, time to ante up and become a team member. So the group dynamic oftentimes has to be changed internally, but is not capable of having the participants change. If it is, I mean, that's a simple way of doing it. I don't do it willingly, though, because it will create some resentment amongst the remaining people. Unless someone is being so uncivil, breaching our civility rules, being so uncivil and obnoxious that everybody can see they should be thrown out, they're out. That's a leadership decision. But you don't often see that. It's usually more subtle than that. Mm-hmm. So, the group dynamic. What should we do to really get it changed? To really find out what needs to be done? Oh, thank you. So many of you are coming in with this answer that it's really heartwarming, because we have talked about it on prior shows. They are archived. Prior shows are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. Mm-hmm. And we have talked about this, and what we're going to do is we're going to break out the 5W questions, aren't we? Yes, many of you. The 5W questions are who, what, where, when, and why. Because we want to know it about the hostility, the mistrust, the bias, the making of cliques, the negativity, and about the person who's trying to disrupt our group. Who, what, where, when, and why? We want to get to the bottom of it. We can't know what to do about it until we know what's causing it. Who, what, where, when, and why. Yeah. Then we can find out how's it going. What is it that we can do? What's the root cause of this? Who, what, where, when, and why. Yes, people are asking when you do this. I'm going to say the same words that you say that I say all the time, because it does. It depends. It depends on the group. I am very careful to be a model of the civility rules, right? Yes. And for those of you who are new, and thank you everyone for being here, Recipe for Peace Now has very few actual rules, but we do have the civility rules. And the civility rules say that we will not be rude to one another at the very base. Now, you can expand them if you've got that kind of a group that needs them to actually be written down, but that's the basis of it. And as leader, we will always model that, right? Right. Because we can't enforce something that we do not adhere to ourselves. Mm-hmm. So when I do the 5W questions, sometimes we go round robin and the group, right? Who, what, where, when, and why. You don't do them all at the same time, by the way, basically speaking, unless you need to. You'll see which ones you need. Sometimes if I have an individual who I need to ask these questions of, I do it in a more one-on-one setting. Like during the breaks when we have the food, right? And it gives us a chance to not be at the table, not be with the whole group, and to take someone aside as leader and find out the 5W questions. What's causing this is the key to it, right? Yeah. And you always ask them, of course, in a very interested and non-aggressive manner, right? Not like you're fighting with them. What kind of an idiot? See, that's not the who, what, where. That's not the what. Even though you might think it, but we're going to be models of civility, right? Right. And I do it privately. It is my temperament to do it privately first and have a little discussion about civility and the 5W questions and why that doesn't apply to this specific instance, these specific issues at this specific time. Right, right, yeah. And then we're going to think about it. If we need to, we can do it in front of the whole group, right? That's the next step, because we've got peer pressure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I look at the situation. I look at the situation. One of the things you need to look at is whether or not, in your experienced judgment, the person who is causing the difficulty is doing it deliberately. Yeah, deliberately. That's one of the key thoughts. Is this sabotage? Or is it just, well, as Hannah says, yes, the 5W questions, and then Hussein says, determine if the hostility and mistrust are personal experience or bigotry. Good point, Hussein. And that's one of the things you need to know, too. Determine if the hostility and mistrust are personal experience or bigotry. Because bigotry, as Lindsay says, is learned behavior, and you can reason with the participant, right? Bigotry is learned behavior, and you can say, well, not here, not at this specific instance, at this specific time. And there is a distinction between personal experience, either with these actual participants or with their generic group, like their ethnicity or something, or learned bigotry that has no basis in personal experience. Right? Right. Which one's easier to overcome is the question that's being asked. they're both going to take some circling around. The hardest, I think, is when, as Hussein says, determine if it's personal experience or bigotry. I think the hardest one is personal experience with these particular people. Yeah, because that's real. Both sides have an unfavorable opinion, right? On the bigotry and the general personal experience, it's usually not both sides. Yeah, there's usually one side being unreasonable, one participant being unreasonable to another. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, yeah, the most, what do I do about the personal ones, the really personal? If I can, my first instinct is to separate them. If I can, and I'm doing like seminars or various meetings, I try to put them in different groups, different classes, come to different meetings so you don't have the friction. It's possible that they will both need to be excused from the group, right? Sometimes the participants with the personal dislike, the personal experience, I often see this because of personal experience, if you know what I mean. They've been lovers, for example, even married and divorced, mm-hmm. which is really nothing to do with the issues, but everything to do with the group dynamic, right? Yeah. And I don't like to dismiss one above the other. I try not to really hard, but sometimes one of the people cannot dismiss, and one of them I can. That's a judgment call. It's kind of an ugly judgment call, especially if it's impactful to your employment. But I try to do something else to assist the person I need to dismiss. Put them into a different group, for example, that's equal. Right? Yeah. Because you just can't have that sniping group dynamic. It's catchy, it's ludicrous, and you will not stand for it. It breaches the civility rules. You explain civility rules very carefully to both of these people, and you expect them to act like adults. That's when I call them out in public, too, if they're not. Right? Yeah. Yes. Devin and others are talking about enforcement and modeling of the civility rules. Do not wait. And we've talked about this before, prior shows. Do not wait to enforce the civility rules or model them until you've let them slide, right? You need to do it right off the bat, right up front, immediately and consistently. If you let it slide, if you go, well, that's not that big a breach and it's just his nature and like that, no. That will be contagious, and then no one will adhere to the civility rules because they'll find out they don't have to, is what it really is. They're like little children, and they'll find out that they don't have to adhere to the civility rules, so they won't. You need to enforce the civility rules immediately and very, with everybody understanding it and modeling it, right? Yeah. Right from the beginning, take no nonsense. Mm-hmm. And I plan on to tell people that I take no nonsense. It makes it very, very clear. You know I'm big on transparency. Yeah. How else are we going to keep the group dynamic from going hostile and how are we going to solve it if it has and making clicks and doing all kinds of bad things, right? Then others are talking about using one of those servers for discussions so that everyone is included in all communications and it can be monitored for negativity and incivility. And then people can be blocked, right? Yeah, Kristen and others are talking about using a server for discussions. So what really not a server, service, pardon me, a service for discussions. Big files and stuff, we use Dropbox with pictures and GoToMeeting or something for written communications up and back. But yes, it is important to use a service, but they're free. It's important to use one of those computer services if you can. And, well, some countries is not as good as others. To use one of those business services so that you can really have all the communications in one spot and you can see what's going on. Because if you just rely on people to just email each other up and back, then you will get exclusion, right? People will not put you on the CC of the email. But this way, we communicate only through the service, only through the platform, where we can see all of the communications, and we can, and the leader will monitor it and make certain that nobody is violating the civility rules, right? And you can, of course, block people from getting back into the group. It's kind of a drastic measure. It's also potentially temporary. Yeah? It's like sitting in the corner, right? It's you don't get to be in it until you take three deep breaths and be civil. Well, you know, there's something to be said for that. And everybody knows, right? Yeah. So yes, we do indeed. It's very important that all communication go to everybody, and that we not have exclusions so nobody knows what's going on, or only little pockets of people know what's going on. It's also a good way to for the leader and leader staff to monitor how it's going with the assignments, how we're doing, if we're really getting there and really working on it, and if somebody needs help. Or we've gone kind of off track and they don't realize it. It just kind of, that's not exactly what we had in mind, right? Yeah. Yes. You know, this is a good point that Muhammad is making. Muhammad says, we're not trying to create friends. You need a working group environment, working group dynamic for these specific issues. Yeah. Not, you're not trying to create friends. You're trying to create change, right? And you need a working group dynamic for these specific issues. Good point. Good point that, and we say this right up front, not exactly friends, but at least willing participants, right? Don't have to be friends. We just have to get this done because it's in all of our best interests. Yes. And you know, I come right out and say the faster we get this done, the more efficient we are, the faster we get rid of having to meet with each other. And the issues will get resolved. We'll have a successful outcome, which is good for all of us. And then we'll move on with our lives. Yeah, so sit up straight and participate. But it does work. And surprisingly enough, that seems to be a surprising statement to many people. I don't know why. But yeah, they seem to be shocked by the fact that if they work real efficiently and we get to the outcome that we need, we don't have to see each other again. That may be the best incentive of all. Yeah, not trying to create friends, as Muhammad says. You need a working group dynamic for these specific issues. You know, there's quite a bit of discussion going on, and thank you very much, about the group dynamic being changed by changing the participants. We just kind of talked about that, right? Sometimes the group dynamic, and they're not getting anywhere because the leader is not very good. They need to change leader. I get called in on that a lot. It's an interesting dynamic when the group has already been working for a while, usually, and they're not getting anywhere, and they're feeling frustrated, and they've got the hostility and mistrust going that's personal, and their leader doesn't know what he or she is doing, and you get called in to take that over and to be the new leader. and maybe even the old leader is still there as a participant and can't be dismissed, right? Mm-hmm. This is where we go for the 5W questions, assert our civility rules, and tell everybody that there is indeed a new leader, and that will change the group dynamic for the better. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. People are saying it could be for the worst in those situations. Well, I suppose you can always make something worse. But, yeah, the leaders sometimes change. Sometimes you need to bring in someone who has been a leader in a different group, and you need to make them co-leaders,
yeah,
so that they don't lose their position. They don't become embarrassed because they are no longer the leader, and therefore they won't come in. They won't help because they feel that they are being snubbed, right? Yeah, that's very important to always remember that people are proud of their leadership. They're proud that they've gotten as far as they have. They're proud that people follow them, right? And you can't just say, you know, come and join with us and you sit down over there in the participant group while I take over. No, they want to be a leader too. They want to still remain of importance. Even if we can all see it would be a good thing for them to, well, to come with us, right? But they still need to have a position where they can be respected and not lose face, right? Yeah, not lose stature in the eyes of really their beholders, of their members, of their participants. Yeah, and that goes to perception, which is our next group. Mm-hmm. Yeah. People are talking about dividing the cliques. Mm-hmm. And then we'll get to perception. Yeah, dividing the exclusionary subgroups. Austin says divide the cliques, the exclusionary subgroups into different teams. I do that a lot. If we're going to make teams, I'm very careful not to make one of the teams the clique accidentally. Oh, good point. People are saying sometimes the cliques are very effective, though, because they really work well together. That's a judgment call. I usually think of a clique as kind of a negative, but I can see the point. And I do create teams of people who have worked together before as successfully, because there's no sense in reinventing the wheel, right? And I suppose that is encouraging a clique to exist so that we can have more efficiency. Yeah, it's a good point. Sometimes groups that come in kind of as a group are good for the group dynamic, are good for efficiency, are good for getting things done. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. We're very practical people. And we want to get to our successful outcome. We want to get things done. Right? Right. Yeah. And that's really the ultimate goal, isn't it? Yes. You know, Marcia and others are going for assigned seating. Sometimes, if it's a big enough group, you can divide people up like that. I like to do it in a way that doesn't seem like I'm discriminating. But if you've got people that are kind of texting up and back and giggling together and like that, no, we're going to divide that up. They're not going to be efficient together. They're just going to be mean or, you know, an exclusionary. We don't exclude anybody. That's why we use the service to have everything transparent. Right? Right. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about perception now because we're going to run out of time. Thank you all for all of your participation and for listening and for being here. Thank you. On perception, we just talked about the perception of I haven't lost my leadership position. I have brought us into a bigger group for more power and more clout, but I am still important within the bigger group. And you want to remember that. When you invite people in, invite leaders to join with you, they still want to be perceived that they haven't had a demotion, right? And that perception is very important. It really is. That is not just vanity. That is a very important perception. And people who are leaders, generally speaking, want to appear to remain maybe even more important, right? Yeah. And that's why people have fancy titles and stuff, because it's good. It's something that you can do that doesn't impact anything negatively and makes someone feel that they haven't had a demotion, right? Yeah, they haven't had to compromise. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about perception. Whose perception are we changing? I think is the first question. The one with the leader is internal perception and perception amongst the group and amongst anybody who is dealing with the group, right? Yeah. So it's perception of followers, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are the kind of perception? Well, really, perception is viewing possibility, right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Some of you are going for perception as a negative, right? Because you want to make the perception that the other side is no good, is wrong, is dangerous. I've seen that. We were having a kind of a funny political year in the United States. You know, it's presidential elections. And we've got two rather unusual candidates, and they're slinging mud. They're doing negative perception, especially Trump, who is the Republican nominee. I assume this is tomorrow. It's official, and he's actually calling his opponent, Hillary Clinton, kind of names in an uncivil manner, right? I mean, we'd never put up with it in one of our groups, right? Yeah, he is. He's being kind of uncivil and kind of a bully. And her camp, her political advisors, they're getting more towards name-calling too, which is really weird because it's a public perception of negativity. Yeah, of which one do you dislike the least? Yeah, and especially Trump is going for a negative campaign. Mm-hmm. Yes, perception of the participants, perception of the leader, maybe perception of the public, to know what they think of you, especially if the public has to do something, vote for something, change a social idea, right? Something that's a custom you'd like to have revised or changed or eliminated, right? You know, life evolves, society evolves. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes, as Thomas and others are pointing out, perception changes as to what is right and what is wrong. And now you would think that that wouldn't be true, but it is. Sometimes a group, what we are doing, is to really set the basis, to create a perception that something that has always been thought of one way is wrong and that it should be revisited in the modern world. Right? Right. Yeah. And, okay, let's not argue this point. People are asking for an example. In the United States, in the military, being a homosexual was grounds for dishonorable discharge, for many, 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 many years. Somebody told me it was all the way down to George Washington, who didn't like what was then called buggery, if you know what I mean. Yes, it was homosexual activity. And that was also pervasive in the society. But the military moves kind of slowly, I think. And it was really forbidden, and if you got caught, you got thrown out, period. There was groups of people who lobbied, and society's perception changed, right? So that it wasn't embarrassing. It was generally thought of as positive. When the military changed their rules about it, actually their core rules about being a homosexual, they had, I don't know if this is still true because I don't do military work, but I know that they went for don't ask, don't tell. You didn't ask people about their sexual orientation, and they asked you not to volunteer it, right? Now I believe it is okay to be in a homosexual relationship in the military rules, right? Yeah, that's a tremendous perception change because that's a perception of what is right and what is wrong, right? Yeah, that's an actual shift in public perception too because the public needed to be behind it or the military wouldn't have done it. And there was huge amounts of organized lobbying and organized protests, too, about the old law that caused the perception, the shift in perception of if this is a bad thing, an illegal thing to engage in a homosexual relationship, or shift in perception and change. Is it private? It's a sexual preference. Right? Mm-hmm. There were actually laws on the book about homosexuality being illegal. Yes, a lot of people are talking also about that the perception has changed also. At one time, within the memory of the modern world, if you know what I mean, we had laws on the books about not being able to cross ethnic lines to get married. Yes, I can't remember what the word was. Assignation? It'll come to me. But in any event, yeah, you couldn't get different people of different races couldn't get married by law. And now all of those have been overturned, right? Yeah. And perception has changed as to whether or not that's an okay thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So perception changes. And it usually changes because groups work very hard to change the law, right? Yeah. And groups like our groups, they go step by step. And they change public perception so that the private perception can be changed too. And the military and the government are not that private, but the laws wouldn't have changed if not for the fact that groups got together and pushed forward for the change. And now it seems very ordinary within the society, right? Nobody thinks about whether or not that's legal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. Georgia says that public participation to change the laws is necessary, so you need a media war with opposing views. Yeah, there always are opposing views, right? Mm-hmm. And so you do indeed nowadays blitz the media so that people can understand your side of it, so that people can go, oh, that seems fair to me, for example. Yeah, so perception. Mm-hmm. And it does. Perception changes. And it changes because of groups, because of the work of groups in creating an idea in the public, in others, that something needs to be done. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now let's go down to future change, or we're going to run out of time. And I'm going to try to get in one of the recipes. I know you guys like it, and it just sometimes it just doesn't work. We run out of time because we have such wonderful discussions. Thank you all for being here. And now the last topic that we were going to talk about under creating change was creating future change. Yeah, change that would change now, that's for now too, but also for the future. Sometimes even when we've got new regulations, for example, this happens a lot in the United States with pollution regulations. Something that a business must do and must install equipment for, and it's quite expensive. Sometimes laws go in, are put on the books, and they are indeed laws, but they don't go into effect for a couple of years because it would be a tremendous hardship on whoever it is that's being affected, right? Yeah. And so they are going into effect in 2020, say. So it's a few years down the road. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes it's, they're kind of big projects, too, in some way. Some sort of a construction project or something. I've seen that. Have we started? Yeah. Have we gotten the permissions and the permits? Hope so. But we need to have some for the future, have rules for the future for when that's going to be in business. Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is true. Michael and others just say that when you have future change, you need to understand the process. It has to be transparent. We all have to understand it. We all have to understand what it is that we are doing. What's the process? What needs to be done? What needs to be finished? Mm-hmm. Yeah, an understanding of the process is kind of important. Mm-hmm. In fact, I always say people say, how long will this take? And if you can give a guesstimate, big. Yeah, not so big that people will run away screaming, but big enough so that if you come in a little under, that's impressive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so understanding of the process and the time involved. Mm-hmm. Russ Mira says that the main thing is that people have to have diligence and determination, mm-hmm, and understand that it's worth the effort for lasting change. Worth the effort for lasting change. Yes, we can see that this would be good. It may take us a while, but we're going to keep fighting forward because we're going to keep our diligence and our determination, because it's worth the effort for lasting change. Yeah. It's a good point that Barbara and others are making, that when you're going to go for future change, it needs to be done carefully and with expert consultation so you get the intended future change. Oh, isn't that true? Sometimes we all have an idea. We all know something that needs to be changed. And we need indeed to do it carefully and use the process carefully. Pardon me. Which is oftentimes why I'm called in as a leader, because I am a lawyer and I've got a lot of experience. But we need to, especially if we're changing a law, it's being written down. We need to, as Barbara said, it needs to be done carefully and with expert consultation so you get the intended future change. We need to have fresh eyes look at what we're doing. Sometimes you get too close. It's been a while. We've gone up and back with several drafts. We think we've got it. When we think we've got it, I call in an expert. I do. And I have them look over what we've done and see if, A, we're really done, because there may be some points that we didn't think on, and, B, if it is clear what it is that we want and what it is that you should do to effectuate what it is that we want, right? Yeah. It's very important to get, before you bring something out into the world, because sometimes things do have the most unintended consequences, right? Right. Yes. And hard facts make bad law, which is an old homily. And it's true. Hard facts make bad law. Yes. Mm-hmm. And Carl and others are saying that you need to come together as a unified team with a clear goal. A unified team with a clear goal. Yes. People are asking about unintended consequences. And the little expression about hard facts make a bad law. Some years ago, and this is kind of a hard facts example, I suppose. There was especially when it became possible, well, it's more than a few years ago by now, but we still got the effects of the bad law. When it became possible to transplant human parts, yes, that you could get a new kidney or something from a live donor, there was some horrific abuse, especially in institutions for the mentally unstable. Because they had healthy bodies, right? Right, yes. And there was big money in it. Mm-hmm. And used to be able to pay for a part. And unscrupulous people provided the part. Got the drift? Yes. And that was absolutely horrible. And so there was a lot of very kind of indignant law passed about regulating that. We got a whole layer of government, and now there's a tremendous waiting list because there's all kinds of rules about the donor and the donee and like that. There's kind of, it's getting better because the rules are getting more unified. But there's still tremendous barriers to getting a body part donated, usually by a stranger. Now, if it's something that can be donated by a relative, that's also a lot of rules, but it's different. Are the rules bad? No, of course they're not. They're not bad laws. There's an entire government agency that oversees these laws. Are they bad on their face? No. But they led to a lot of complications that weren't intended. The intention was to prevent unscrupulous, horrible people from acquiring donors who are unwitting. And basically speaking, killing them. Yeah? Yeah. So that was what the intent was. The rules, the laws themselves have gotten kind of convoluted. Yeah? And they could really use an overhaul, but nobody's asked me to do it. But, yeah, so that's kind of unintended consequences. You have to have some third party look at it and go, is this what we wanted it to do? Is this right? Is it what we want? Yeah. So it needs to be done carefully. It is true. And I always call in an expert to consult on that. Just because you get too close and you've worked on it too hard and you're positive that is finally it. But sometimes it's not. You've just kind of gotten tired. And you haven't thought of all the different elements. And sometimes it's a question of a few words artfully embedded that makes it more clear. Because all this stuff goes before courts and gets interpreted. And you need to get the interpretation to be what you meant, because what you did was very, very clear. Right? Right, yeah. So we're going to need to come together as a unified team with a clear goal for all of this, right? So we can create positive change and we can get to our successful outcome, right? Yes. And one of the ways we're going to do that is we're going to use food as a tool. Yes, I left about 4 minutes. We ought to be able to get one of the recipes in. I know a lot of you look forward to it, so I'm trying to be better about it. Sometimes we kind of talk through the recipe part because we get excited. Yes. So you're going to have some food in the room so we can take a break and have something delightful. It also makes the room smell really nice. And it gives us a way to connect with each other that's not around the table and potentially has the feeling that it might turn into hostility. Right? Right. Yes, and you as leader are the host or hostess, so to speak. So you get people together and encourage people not to hide around the corners, right? And also it is a good moment, since the food is a tool, for you as leader to quietly talk to someone who needs help with the group dynamic. Now, we're going to have food. Yes, I know I say this each time. People remind me, too, because I do forget. If we're going to have food, and we are, you need to take a survey and ask if anybody has a religious prohibition, a food prohibition, something they don't eat, an allergy, and you will disseminate this information to everybody. When people bring stuff, wonderful things, you're going to ask them to also bring a list, not what it's called, but what is in it so that we can know if we can eat it, so it can run our eyes down the list. I also think we should have a safe recipe, something that everybody can eat. And an adventure recipe is always fun. It is, we've taken our survey, and our people this time can eat pork. Because a lot of times that's not true. There's religious and just personal opinion prohibitions about pork. So we're going to do the adventure recipe this time. Last time we did the safe recipe. And this adventure recipe, I know. Guys, I know you guys actually email me and say, when are you going to get to it? It's been hanging around for a few weeks now. Sorry about that. But it's the pancetta pork. Oh, so delicious. This is, of course, very porky, and you have to know if somebody won't eat pork within your group. It's the adventure recipe, right? Right. So we're going to have some fresh rosemary because it's going to be delicious and smell fabulous. Chopped up about 3 tablespoons of it. If you can get it fresh, that'd be fabulous. If not, I suppose you can use the dried stuff. I don't know if this is a good idea or a bad idea, but this is what I do. When I've got the dried, I put it in a little bit of hot water and just let it sit there for a little while. I think it makes it more like the fresh. I don't know if that's true or not. It may be psychological. Let's have 6 cloves of garlic minced up. I use lots of garlic. If you think I use too much, then just put in less. Let's have some microplaned lemon peel, like a whole lemon's worth, maybe 4 teaspoons worth, right? Let's have as much pork as we can get, is what it really is. We're going to have between 6 and 8 pounds of pork. But you know the pork, the boneless pork top loin, the really nice one that's all boneless and everything, and usually has that layer of fat on the top. Ooh, yummy. It doesn't come so big, each one of them. So we're going to get 2 of them. And 2 of the boneless pork top loin roast, yeah. They call it a pork sirloin roast around here. I don't know why that is. It's the boneless one that's kind of soft and delicious and has the piece of fat on the top. We're going to buy 2 of them that are about the same size, not in weight but in actual physical size, because we're going to tie them together. And we want that to happen neatly. So I always pick 2 of them that are as big as I can get and are about the same length. Does that make sense? Yeah, because some of them are kind of wide and some of them are kind of long. I like to pick the 2 long ones. I would get 2 4-pounders if I could find it, whatever's the biggest. And let's have, about 1/2 pound of thinly sliced pancetta. Yeah. Do use pancetta. You can use prosciutto if you want. It's a little more expensive, for one thing, and it is a little fatty. Can you use regular ham? I'm going to go for pancetta. because I'm scared of saying that you can use the regular ham, because some of that stuff has been over-processed. It's kind of wet. And no, you can't use the kind of sandwich meat, regular ham. If you're going to do that, skip the pancetta part and just stuff it full of more herbs and garlic and stuff. You know what I mean? Don't put something in the middle that's going to be weird when it's cooked. Anyway. So we're going to take a little bowl and we combine the rosemary and the garlic and the lemon peel. We're going to take that lovely two pieces of meat, and we're going to spread this lovely rosemary and garlic and lemon peel mixture really over the top of one of them. And then we're going to put the pancetta on the top of that because, you know, the law of gravity gets to things, right? Right. And so we're spreading it all on the top. And then if you've got a fat layer on both pieces of meat, they come like that around here. I must confess, they come in like a sealed package, and they put a piece of fat on the top. Put the fat on the outside, and you're spreading this on the non-piece of fat side in the middle. You've got the pancetta. You've got all the herbs and everything all spread out real nice. We're going to take the other piece of pork loin, plop it on top, fat side up, right? And the fat side up on the other one, so there's the fats on the outside. And we're going to tie it with kitchen twine, with cotton kitchen string. Now, this is a thing that you make the day before. You've got it all tied up. You've got all the herbs in there. Yeah, if you've got bigger pieces of meat, make more herb. It's kind of a marinade, right? So what we're going to do is we're going to wrap it in plastic wrap, and we're going to stick it in the fridge so that it marinates and all the delicious food, all the delicious flavors get in. Yeah, that's it. People say leave off the pancetta altogether. You could. And stick in a little bit more of the herbs, right? And then the other kind of herb that you really like. And you tie them tight. You make a little packet. You wrap it in saran wrap. You wrap it in plastic wrap. And you stick it in the fridge overnight. You can do it for, I would not do it for less than 8, or really more than 24, because I don't like to keep pork and stuff around so long. But overnight, right? We're going to take a 325 preheated oven. We're going to put this lovely bundle of pork in to be roasted. 3 hours, maybe. Use the meat thermometer and you take a look at it. When you take it out of the oven, and even maybe when you bring it to the potluck, wrap it, especially if you bring it to the potluck, when you take it out of the oven, wrap it in tin foil, in aluminum foil, real fast, so that all the juices and stuff stays in and it kind of keeps marinating and cooking. And bring it like that, and then put it in a pan or whatever, and then take it out of the foil and slice it when you get there. Because it'll keep all the juices in and keep all the yumminess in. If you've got it in the room as you're standing there, and have it sit for about 10 minutes with the foil on it. Wrap it kind of around in foil. Because otherwise, when you go to cut it, the juices will squish out and it won't look as nice and it won't make as firm a piece. So this is the kind of a thing that you make the night before, put in the fridge, then you cook it up, about 3 hours, give or take, depending how big your meat is, and then you wrap it in the foil, and you take it with you. It's fabulous. And when you unwrap it, not only will it smell fabulous, but it'll really be ready to cut into nice slices with a nice sharp knife. Yeah. People asking me about the twine. Secretly, I actually leave the twine on while I'm cutting it because otherwise, I guess my knife's not that sharp. Otherwise, I find that it falls apart a little bit. When you cut it, the pieces of twine will come off because the meat becomes thin, right? You're just slicing it. So I don't think you need to make a big ceremony of snipping it. That's up to you. I mean, you don't want somebody to accidentally eat a piece of twine. I suppose it could happen. Yeah, I suppose you should cut it just to be safe. Yeah, just snip it with the scissors. I usually just kind of slice the whole thing so that people don't have to slice their own, which is indeed messy. So I slice the whole thing one after another, and as I'm going to serve it, I just pick the piece of twine out. There's, what, about six of them, depending on how long it was. I just pick it out. I just, yeah, I don't particularly cut it because I think it's easier to slice when it's all held together, and then I take the twine out. I don't leave the twine on the plate, though, because, A, it's ugly, and, B, you never know. I mean, somebody could have a morphs and not be familiar with it. So, my friends, we are out of time. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. If you would like to contact us, we are at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Prior shows, they're archived on that website, recipeforpeacenow.com. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening and for all of your participation. And please do come again. Bye-bye.